Love. You know, suppose a mother whose child has traveled, for example. Every moment, mom is thinking about the child. Now, my child is, for example, sleeping. What is he doing now? Does he have proper bed, etc.? Now is time of, for example, breakfast. Does he have anything to eat? What is he doing? Now he's going to, for example, university. He has to go from the, for example, dorm to the class. What is he doing? When you love someone, you keep thinking about him. A lover of Imam Zaman is not only thinking about him on Friday morning, or, for example, I don't know, middle of Sha'ban. A lover of Imam Zaman naturally, not by force, naturally keeps thinking about him, because Imam Zaman for him is a way to connect to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And since he loves Allah, he loves his Khalifa, he loves his Hujjah, he loves his true servant.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir. Rahi Karimun Adim Alimun Halim Hakimun Mateen شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين
On behalf of myself and all of my colleagues here at Arabi English Radio, we wish you a wonderful Nowruz, full of happiness and prosperity.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked among
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism. This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Rafi'i. Stay tuned.
Thank you.
ما برای همه ادیان الهی احترام قائلیم.
We Muslims respect all the monotheistic religions across the world. We Muslims love Prophet Jesus Christ. We Muslims love Prophet Moses. By the same token, disrespecting Prophet Jesus and Moses is like disrespecting Prophet Muhammad. However, loving the prophets of Allah does not mean converting to the religions before Islam. Islam is the final religion, and we as Muslims must not let our love for Islam and Prophet Muhammad be tainted.
محبت رو به کسانی ببرزیم که خدا گفته اینا رو دوست داشته باشید.
We must love those who Allah ordered us to love. Those are Ahlul Bayt and Ma'sumin. As we read in Surah Ash-Shura, Ayah 23, such is the good news that Allah gives to His servants who have faith and do righteous deeds. Say, I do not ask you any reward for it, except the love of my relatives. Whoever performs a good deed, we shall enhance its goodness for him. Indeed, Allah is all forgiving, all appreciative. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Rafi'i. To find out more about this program, log on to our website www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We'll leave you in Allah's care.
In the limelight.
Gazan farmers fear a season of ruined crops and the long-term consequences of the Zionist regime's ongoing practice, says Maha Hosseini, writer, in an article titled Zionist Regime Carries Out Aerial Spraying of Herbicides Near Palestinian Farmlands. Stay tuned for more. For 4 days in a row, the Zionist regime crop duster planes have been flying near the eastern Gaza Strip, spraying chemicals believed to be herbicides in close to Palestinian lands adjacent to the border fence. The frequency of the spray is determined by the direction of the wind. Eyewitnesses say, adding that the spray stops when it rains or when the wind blows in the opposite direction. They only start spraying along the border fence when the wind blows west in the direction of the Palestinian lands in order to allow the herbicides to cover a larger area inside our lands, Palestinian farmer Yusuf Abu Maqadid told Middle East Eye recently. adding, but when the wind starts blowing east, they immediately stop because it would harm them. In Gaza, around 40,000 Palestinians depend on farming as their only source of livelihood. Magadid estimates that the latest spraying was conducted over at least 60 hectares of farmland, directly affecting the livelihood of 35 to 40 farmers. The Zionist regime army regularly claims that the herbicides are used to clear vegetation in the buffer zone in Gaza side of the fence in order to have a clearer view of the area for military purposes. But Palestinians say the policy inflicts wide-ranging damage on the residents of Gaza. Magadid accused the Zionist regime authorities of intentionally damaging Palestinian crops in the eastern farmlands using various tactics over the years. He said, "We have been going through the same scenario for years now. Every couple of weeks, they send drones to spray our lands to damage the crops so that they can monitor the area more clearly. Sometimes this happens only a few days before the harvest season. You can imagine the amount of losses we endure." Aside from the spraying of herbicides, Palestinian farmers also have to deal with the constant firing of tear gas by the Zionist regime forces deployed along the border fence in eastern Gaza. Magadid said, just today alone, the Zionist regime forces fired more than 10 tear gas canisters at shepherds to keep them away from the buffer zone. But the wind blows the gas towards us and we have to leave our land several times a day to avoid inhaling it. This happens on a daily basis and several times a day. According to rights groups, the Zionist regime has been conducting aerial herbicide spraying in this area for several years, and the activity is typically carried out without prior notification or warning to Palestinian farmers. The Zionist regime carries out the spraying when the wind is blowing westward, which transports the chemicals deep into Gaza, reaching distances as far as 1,200 meters into the strip, activists say. Since 2014, the clearing and bulldozing of agricultural and residential lands by the Zionist regime military close to the eastern border of Gaza has been completed by unannounced aerial spraying of crop-killing herbicides, the research group Forensic Architecture found in 2019. The London-based agency spent over a year examining the environmental and legal implications of the Zionist regime practice of aerial spraying of herbicides along the Gaza border. The agency said in a statement, "This ongoing practice has not only destroyed entire swathes of formerly arable land along the border fence, but also crops and farmlands hundreds of meters deep into the Palestinian territory, resulting in the loss of livelihoods for Gazan farmers." Farmers would not see the full scope of damage caused by herbicides until days or weeks after the spraying activity, said Iyad Abu Qalba. "We still cannot determine if the spraying has incurred any damage to the crops. It usually takes up to 8 to 10 days until dark spots start appearing on the leaves, and this is when we know that they are damaged and cannot be harvested," the local farmer told MEE. "We are supposed to harvest the crops, including peppers, courgettes, and wheat, in the next 2 or 3 months. If the herbicides have indeed affected the crops, which we will know in around a week, then the whole season is ruined and tens of thousands of dollars are lost," Abu Qalba said. As a result, many farmers are facing increasing debts due to the Zionist regime's continuous practice aimed at damaging Palestinian crops, Abu Qalba added. The situation worsened when the Zionist regime attacked Gaza in May 2021, leading to an estimated loss of $204 million in Gaza's agricultural sector, according to the Palestinian Ministry of Agriculture. Abu Ghalba said, "We are still struggling with the consequences of the last attack on Gaza that causes us huge damage due to the shelling and leveling of lands, as well as abandoning the crops throughout the 11 days of the attack and then having to deal with the Zionist regime's decision to close the borders and prevent exports. We are not ready for another year in which our agricultural lands are targeted continuously."
ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام می‌گذاره، همه این ارزش‌ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
The universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time. And in today's world, overcome by evil and darkness, and oppression and slavery, and tyranny and falsehood, a quick look into this beacon of truth and justice, a look into the universal persona of Imam Ali, is greatly useful for making and changing our lives, our families, our societies, and our world into the beautiful world that Allah has planned for humanity.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام: من عظم صغار المصائب ابتلاه الله بكبارها.
أمير المؤمنين إمام علي عليه السلام stated: Whoever regards small distresses as big, Allah involves him in big ones.
Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio. The program's To My Brother, and we were discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali, alayhi salam.
So one of the great lessons that we learn from Imam Ali alayhi salam, peace and blessings upon him, is the importance of knowledge, insight, and friendliness. Knowledge, of course, in Arabic is known as ilm, and insight is known as basira. Now, we find in the book of Al-Manaqib that there is the following tradition recorded. Harith Awar Hamdani has reported that the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household, said, while this person, Harith Awar Hamdani, says that the Holy Prophet was among his companions when he said the following statement. The Holy Prophet says, I will soon show you Adam in his knowledge, Noah in his insight, and Abraham in his friendliness. And so right as the Holy Prophet said this, Imam Ali, peace and blessings upon him, joined the Holy Prophet's companions. Now Imam Ali did not necessarily know what the Holy Prophet was just talking about. So Abu Bakr, who happened to become the first caliph of the Muslims, was also present in this gathering, and he said, Ya Rasulullah, O Messenger of Allah, you have compared a man with three prophets. How happy will this man be? Then Abu Bakr says, Now let us know who this man is. The Holy Prophet Muhammad replies, Do you not know him? Abu Bakr says, No, Messenger of Allah, for his messenger knows better than we do. We do not know this person. The Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings upon him, says, That man is Ali ibn Abi Talib. Allahu Akbar. Turning approvingly to Imam Ali, Abu Bakr says, May you enjoy these virtues, O Abul Hasan. Is there anyone like you who has such a high position? Allahu Akbar. From all the different points which we can take out from this, such as the fact that it was clear for people like the first caliph, Abu Bakr, that Imam Ali excelled in so many qualities and had such a high position that truly the caliphate, the leadership of the Muslims, should have been given to Imam Ali. But let us go back to what we started our discussion with, and that is the importance of knowledge, insight, and friendliness. This is one of the profound and main lessons which we learn from this tradition here, talking about the universal persona of Imam Ali, and that is that as regards to knowledge, it is Imam Ali who was like Prophet Adam, and so we too should seek knowledge. Second, that as far as insight, when regards to Prophet Noah, Imam Ali was like him, and so we too should look and gain insight. And finally, when we want to look at the friendliness of somebody such as Prophet Abraham, who is famous and well known amongst the Arabs and even the non-Arabs, such as the Bani Israel, the Israelites, that Abraham was the most friendly person, then Imam Ali was like him. And so we too should be friendly, have knowledge, and have insight. Beautiful and profound lessons brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
تبقى عيني بدمع مشتاقيا قد لسعت حية الهوى كبدي فلا تبيب لها ولا راغي
تمام ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به اسلام چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به هر دینی
human in general whether a muslim non-muslim or even a disbeliever respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib. This means Ali ibn Abi Talib is a global character who is respected by Sunnis, Shias, and even non-Muslims. Everyone, even the faithless people, respect Imam Ali and his personal values.
In the name of Allah, Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. Welcome to this segment of To My Brother. My name is Muhammad. After returning from the Battle of Siffin, Imam Ali gave certain pieces of advice to one of his sons. Historians consider him to be Imam Hassan alayhi salam, while others are of the opinion that he was Muhammadul Hanafiya. He wrote this letter in the form of a will. They deal with almost every aspect of life, which goes a long way to make a man successful in life, brave, humane, generous, virtuous, and pious. Today, I'm going to read to you an excerpt from the last will of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Please stay with us. My dear son, carefully and very carefully remember these sayings of mine. The Lord, who is the master of death, is also the master of life. The Creator is the annihilator, and the one who annihilates has the power to bring everything back to existence. The one who sends calamities has also the power to protect you from them. Remember that this world is working under the laws ordained by Him, and it consists of assemblage and aggregation of actions and reactions, causes and effects, calamities and reverses, pains and pleasures, and rewards and punishments. But this is not all which the picture depicts. There are things in it which are beyond our ken, things which we do not and cannot know, and things which cannot be foreseen and foretold, for example, their rewards and punishments on the Day of Judgment. Under these circumstances, if you understand a thing, do not reject it. Remember that your lack of understanding is due to insufficiency of your knowledge. Remember that when you came into this world, your first appearance was that of an ignorant, uneducated, and unlearned being. Then you gradually acquired knowledge. But there were several things which were beyond your knowledge, which perplexed and surprised you, and about which you did not understand. Gradually, you acquired knowledge about some of those subjects. Future, your knowledge and vision may further expand.
Now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Rizvi.
In Sermon 197, he says, وَعَنَا وَاللَّهِ when he says here regarding this issue of minbar, that I am following the sunnah of Rasulullah and the verdicts of Rasulullah, In that khutbah, he says, وَلَقَدْ عَلِمَ الْمُسْتَحْفَظُونَ مِنْ أَصْحَابِ مُحَمَّدٍ. The companions of Muhammad who have retained the events of the days of Rasulullah, they know أَنِّي لَمْ أَرُدُّ عَلَى اللَّهِ وَعَلَى رَسُولِهِ سَاعَةَ قَطُّ. They know that I never ever, even for a moment, opposed Allah or Rasul. And at the end he says, فَمَنْ ذَا أَحَقُّ بِهِ مِنِّي حَيًّا وَمَيِّتًا. I was with Rasul, supporting him, sacrificing my own life for him whenever the opportunity would come to defend him. And he says, I am the first, last one who got the opportunity to be with him when his last breath was coming out. I was the one who gave ghusl, and the malaika were helping me. And he says, so who can be more closer and more rightful to get to take that position after Rasul during the time when he was alive as well as after his wafat?
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
in the limelight.
Everybody is ignoring the deeper structural reason for price increases. The concentration of the American economy into the hands of a few corporate giants with the power to raise prices, says Robert Reich Ryder in an article published under the heading, "The U.S. Underlying Problem Isn't Inflation, It's Corporate Power and Greed." Stay tuned for more. Inflation, inflation. Everybody is talking about it in the U.S., but ignoring one of its biggest causes, corporate concentration. Now prices are undeniably rising. In response, the Fed is about to slow the economy, even though there are still 2 million jobs short of where they were before the pandemic, and millions of American workers won't get the raises they deserve. Meanwhile, Republicans haven't wasted any time hammering Biden and Democratic lawmakers about inflation. Don't fall for their fear-mongering. Everybody is ignoring the deeper structural reason for price increases. The concentration of the American economy into the hands of a few corporate giants with the power to raise prices. If the market were actually competitive, corporations would keep their prices as low as possible as they competed for customers. Even if some of their costs increased, they would do everything they could to avoid passing them to customers in the form of higher prices for fear of losing business to competitors. But that's the opposite of what we're seeing. Corporations are raising prices even if they take in record profits. Corporate profits margins hit record highs last year. You see, these corporations have so much market power, they can raise prices with impunity. So the underlying problem isn't inflation per se. It's a lack of competition. Corporations are using the excuse of inflation to raise prices and make fatter profits. Take the energy sector. Only a few entities have access to the land and pipelines that control the oil and gas powering most of the world. They took a hit during the pandemic, as most people stayed home, but they are more than making up for it now, limiting supply and ratcheting up prices. Or look at consumer goods. In April 2021, Procter & Gamble raised prices on staples like diapers and toilet paper, citing increased costs in raw material and transportation. But P&G has been making huge profits. After some of its price increases went into effect, it reported an almost 25% profit margin. Looking to buy the people's diapers elsewhere? Good luck. The market is dominated by P&G and Kimberly-Clark, which not entirely coincidentally raised its prices at the same time. Another example, in April 2021, PepsiCo raised prices, blaming higher costs for ingredients, freight, and labor. It then recorded $3 billion in operating profits through September. How did it get away with this without losing customers? Pepsi has only one major competitor, Coca-Cola, which promptly raised its own prices. Coca-Cola recorded $10 billion in revenues in the third quarter of 2021, up 16% from the previous year. Food prices are soaring, but half of that is from meat, which cost 15% more than last year. There are only four major meat processing companies in America, which are all raising their prices and enjoying record profits. The U.S. underlying problem is not inflation, it's corporate power. Since the 1980s, when the U.S. government all but abandoned antitrust enforcement, two-thirds of all American industries have become more concentrated. Most are now dominated by a handful of corporations that coordinate prices and production. This is true of banks, broadband, pharmaceutical companies, airlines, meat packers, and yes, soda. Corporations in all these industries could easily absorb higher costs, including long overdue wage increases, without passing them on to customers in the form of higher prices. But they aren't. Instead, they're using their massive profits to line the pockets of major investors and executives, while both consumers and workers get shafted. How can this structural problem be fixed? Fighting corporate concentration with more aggressive antitrust enforcement and imposing a windfall profits tax on profitable corporations that are using this period of rising costs to gouge consumers. So don't fall for the fear-mongering about inflation. The real culprit here is corporate power.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Spokesman for Yemen's armed forces, Brigadier General Yahya Sari'a, says Sana'a has staged a fresh retaliatory operation against the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia in a bid to break the all-out blockade Riyadh has imposed on its southern neighbor. Yahya Sari'a noted that targets in Saudi Arabia's port city of Jeddah, as well as Jizan, have been struck in the third phase of special operations. Earlier, Sari announced the second phase, saying Yemeni forces had conducted major operations, which he described as special in nature, and that the mission had been carried out successfully. He pointed out the large-scale operation has been staged with a batch of ballistic missiles and drones. According to the spokesman, Phase 2 involved projectiles flying across the border, targeting a number of vital and sensitive sites in the regions of Abha, Khamis Umshayyad, Jizan, and Samata, as well as southern Tehran, with facilities belonging to Saudi oil giant Aramco among the sites targeted. Saudi state media acknowledged a barrage of drone and missile attacks. Despite the kingdom claiming to have intercepted the projectiles, it later reported that drones had hit a petroleum distribution terminal, a natural gas plant, and an oil refinery that led to a temporary reduction in the refinery's production levels. On March 11, Sari announced the first phase of this operation, which also included the bombing of a number of vital and sensitive Saudi facilities affiliated with Aramco in Riyadh, among other areas. He has stressed that the operations come within the framework of Yemen's legitimate right to respond to what he labeled as an unjust siege. According to UN experts, the Saudi-led blockade on Yemen is having a catastrophic effect on millions of people.
The Yemenis have suffered a lot because they cannot import even food or medicine. And the past 70 years have been hell to the Yemenis. And it is now seven painful years for them, and the world is just watching.
Saria has pledged that the Yemeni armed forces will carry out more military operations in the not-so-distant future to break the siege, warning Riyadh the upcoming retaliatory attacks will include sensitive targets that are beyond the imagination of the Saudis. The Saudi war on Yemen is on the brink of its seventh anniversary. On March 26, 2015, Riyadh and a number of its regional allies, backed by the United States, declared war on Yemen. Riyadh said the offensive would take a couple of weeks to achieve its goals, one of which was to restore the former government in Sana'a, whose term had expired but was loyal to the Saudis. However, 7 years later, analysts say the kingdom and its allies, including Washington, have underestimated the determination and the steadfastness of the Yemeni forces and nation to seek sovereignty from Saudi rule. In normal warfare, Saudi Arabia would have the upper hand in this war. Riyadh enjoys unwavering support from the West, in particular the United States. Washington has provided logistical and intelligence backing to the Saudi Air Force, while the UK has trained Saudi pilots. But the real support has come in the form of arms sales. America and its Western allies have sold the Saudis advanced weapons to the tune of hundreds of billions of dollars, making a massive profit. Despite warnings by rights groups of Western complicity in war crimes amid an indiscriminate Saudi bombardment campaign that has killed women and children, Western weapons continue to flow into the kingdom. Despite all this support, the question is, after 7 years, why can't Saudi Arabia win its war on Yemen?
They do not have legitimate goals by waging the war. Number two, their people, their soldiers have become demoralized because of their inability to score victories over the Yemenis. And thirdly, the Yemenis are known historically for their power.
Under a tight blockade, Yemeni forces have manufactured their own indigenous ballistic missiles and drones. Despite their relatively low costs in comparison with Saudi weapons, they have proven very effective. Yemeni officials say they have no choice but to expand retaliatory operations against targets deep inside Saudi Arabia, with the goal of forcing Riyadh to end its blockade and to end its air raids.
Syrian President Bashar al-Assad has visited the United Arab Emirates in his first such visit to an Arab state since the beginning of foreign-backed violence in Syria in 2011. Meeting with Assad on Friday, Abu Dhabi Crown Prince Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan stressed that Syria is a fundamental pillar of Arab security. The Emirati official added that his country is keen to strengthen cooperation with Syria, describing the two nations as brotherly peoples. Assad, for his part, urged that in order to protect the region, the regional countries must continue with adherence to their principles, the sovereignty of their countries, and the interests of their peoples. Assad's visit to the UAE took place only months after the Emirates' foreign minister, Abdullah bin Zayed Al Nahyan, traveled to the Syrian capital, Damascus. It also came amid the widely reported prospect of Damascus' return to the Arab League regional bloc.
So they are, along with the Saudi Arabia, they are rethinking their alliances with the United States, especially, and putting all of their eggs in the United States basket. They are thinking of, let's say, diversifying their alliances along other lines and looking towards China and Russia and other nations.
The recent thaw in relations comes despite the fact that almost all of the region's Arab states turned their backs on Syria in 2014 when Damascus came to face a huge wave of foreign-backed militancy and terrorism. Some of the Arab regimes even began lending financial and logistical support to the anti-Syria elements. Observers say the meeting serves to underline the regional Arab states' interest in resuming their normal relations with Syria, that together with its allies has done much in the way of emerging from the ruins of more than a decade of foreign-backed militancy and terrorism. It's worth noting that the United Arab Emirates used to be among the Arab regimes that backed foreign-sponsored militants operating to topple the Assad government. Experts, however, attribute such signs of rapprochement between Syria and its fellow Arab nations in the region to the Syrian government's ability to recapture vast swaths of its territory and turn the tide against the foreign-sponsored militants and terrorists. The Emirati foreign minister said during his visit to Damascus in November that his country supports efforts to reestablish stability in Syria, adding that what happened in the Syrian nation affected all other Arab countries too. He went so far as to say that Syria, under the leadership of President al-Assad and the efforts of its people, is able to overcome the challenges imposed by the war, noting that his country is always ready to offer assistance to the Syrian people. Yet, the U.S. opposition to warmer relations between its Arab allies and Syria on the one hand, and the UAE's move to normalize ties with Israel on the other, are raising questions about whether a rapprochement is possible between Damascus and Abu Dhabi.
They have seen that that the United States has and its allies have seized, for example, almost $2 billion in Venezuelan gold and then $9 billion in Afghan dollars held in Western banks. And now we're talking about several hundreds of billions of Russian current money in Western banks, which is also being withheld from Russia. They're basically stealing it. So the UAE and Saudi Arabia are both rethinking whether they want to put all of their oil money into dollars which are held in Western banks, or whether they need to create new alliances.
The visit by top Syrian Emirati officials are a clear sign that 11 years of foreign-backed militancy in Syria have failed to achieve the desired result, and that those behind the conflict are beginning to realize that. In recent weeks, the United States has deployed several thousand American troops to Eastern Europe for what it calls helping the security in the region. But how can that help the security when it was part of the main problem why Russia attacked Ukraine in the first place? Moscow has become increasingly wary of NATO's expansion toward its borders and describes it as its red line. One can conclude that more American troops in the region can't help achieving peace there at all. Several U.S. and NATO officials have also noted that they are not looking for a direct conflict with Russia, rejecting Ukraine's calls for establishing a no-fly zone over the country and an offer from Poland to give its entire fleet of warplanes to Kiev. So, if there won't be a war with Russia, what objectives are the U.S. and NATO troops in East Europe accomplishing?
Well, for as secretive as the Pentagon is being with this new wave of deployments, the true goal behind them is fairly obvious. Russia has defied NATO hegemony in Ukraine and has proven that they are capable of both militarily and politically rejecting and defending themselves against NATO aggression. So what the Pentagon wants to do with this new wave of deployments is essentially twofold. They want to simultaneously assert NATO's dominance in the near Russia regions like the Baltic states and the rest of Eastern Europe and Central Asia. And they also want to prepare or at least posture for the preparing of further military aid to support either directly or through further NATO deployments.
Even if the troops are there to conduct military drills, which will, by the way, draw the ire of Russia, there should have been a lot more footage and photos of the troops there, as is usually the norm. But data about what the US troops are doing there has been curiously scarce. The number of American soldiers in Europe has increased by several thousands in the last several weeks. That's according to NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg. Speaking alongside the German Minister of Foreign Affairs, the NATO chief said the 30-member military alliance has increased its deterrence and defense, especially in the East, with hundreds of thousands of troops on, quote, heightened alert there. According to Stoltenberg, 60,000 troops are under direct NATO command.
But we face a new reality for our security. So we must reset our collective defense and deterrence for the longer term. Today, we tasked our military commanders to develop options across all domains: land, air, sea, cyber, and space. On land, our new posture should include substantially more forces in the eastern part of the alliance, at higher readiness, with more pre-positioned equipment and supplies.
US President Joe Biden's policy on NATO is a departure from that of the former Trump administration. Back in 2020, Donald Trump planned to withdraw 12,000 US troops from Germany over a spiraling feud with the NATO ally that he accused of taking advantage of the United States on trade. The former president was also critical of European nations for failing to meet NATO's defense budget. But Biden stopped the measure before it even started. The conflict in Ukraine has given the US another excuse to expand its military presence in Europe. Increasing the number of troops overseas means more military costs, which in the event of a war with Russia would be even higher. Can the US and its NATO allies afford the costs and the risks?
Prior to the special military operation in Ukraine, much of the Western media and the Pentagon itself had essentially doubted Russia's military capabilities of defying NATO hegemony, and they were looking to expand NATO influence into Eastern Europe and Central Asia. So they did not view Russia as a threat prior to the special military operation and the essential evisceration of the Ukrainian military during the process of it. So Russia has proven that they can and will oppose NATO hegemony and will defend themselves against NATO aggression.
So far, the West's response to the conflict in Ukraine has been imposing a slew of sanctions on Russia. Whether that can get them what they want, or it turns out to be shooting themselves in the foot amid a deepening energy crisis, is anybody's guess at this point.